Build a polished wardrobe that shows you stay you wherever you go with Mack Weldon. Use code MACK25 for 25% off your first order of $125 or more at MackWeldon.com.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Suzanne Morphew, she vanished on Mother's Day of 2020. And from day one, her husband, Barry, well, his story kind of reeked of performance art. A missing bike, no signs of struggle, and a guy more concerned with trash runs than finding his wife. Fast forward to 2023, Suzanne's remains are found buried in the mountains with traces of a rare animal tranquilizer, BAM, in her bones. The substance only Barry had access to, and its name is BAM. I'm not just emeraling it and saying BAM at random now. Add the dart cap to his laundry. A little weird. Deleted texts, a truck and phone that conveniently went dark, and a wife who just told him she was done, and suddenly Barry's chipmunk shooting alibi doesn't quite hold up. Prosecutors say it's a textbook case of control, planning, and murder. Barry says it's just all a bunch of coincidences. Now, 2025 re-indictment on the table. The question is, will the forensic trail finally stick, or will Barry slide out again on technicalities and doubt? Joining me to discuss, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, and her new book is out, Nightbird, available wherever you get books, and on audiobook, too. That's how I listened in the car on a road trip recently. It was a good read. Suzanne's final text to Barry, Siobhan, it said, I'm done. Let's figure this out civilly. It also said, I don't care what you do or what you're up to. Let's figure this out civilly. Clearly was laying it out there of, mm-hmm. I'm done.
Clear message.
Yeah. Psychologically, how dangerous is it when a partner with controlling tendencies is confronted with that kind of finality?
It is the most dangerous time for a woman to be murdered. And we have many decades of data on that. Most of the, you know, the majority of women who are killed are murdered by a partner or a former partner. It most often happens when they're trying to leave the relationship. And clearly she gave a nice clear message, and it was just a few days later and she disappeared. So another chilling story where she had communicated with her sister that he was physically and emotionally abusive. She had communicated with a friend that she didn't feel safe alone with him. So this is one we wish there would have been a way to intervene earlier. We like to think we can prevent these things, but it's another insidious aspect of, you know, these domestic violence kind of relationships, these controlling narcissistic relationships. And it's, you know, it's horrendous.
It's one of those things where a lot of people, and I don't know what was going on through Suzanne's mind, but I think a lot of us, or pretty much all of us for the most part, like to think, well, it can't get that bad. It can't happen to me. I can't be a Dateline episode. That's a little much. Mm-hmm. Oh, you can be. And and you can be fairly easily. It doesn't take a lot to push someone with these sort of tendencies over a further edge to where this sort of thing took place. She sent the message on May 6, 2020. 3 days later, she vanished. Barry allegedly deleted that message, but saved the screenshot, which I find to be a little weird. What, or maybe it's not. What do you make of that? Deleting the message, keeping the screenshot of the end of your marriage, and just a very stark, clear message of that.
That's a hard one to speculate about. The only thing that comes into my mind was this was carried symbolic meaning for him about why he was justified in taking the action that he took. It's like, here's a reminder to myself about why I needed to do this.
Do you think this is something where he's sitting there for those 3 days after she got that message sent to him, planning how he was going to do this? Was this more of a heat of the moment type thing? She shows back up to get some stuff, and then He's chasing her around the house, allegedly, with the dart gun. I mean, how premeditated do you think this sort of thing was? Considering the evidence and stuff that he put up of like, well, here's why it couldn't be me. I mean, he pretty much walks investigators like right up to all the places he went and why he was there with really stupid excuses.
Mm-hmm. My guess is it was premeditated, and he may have been fantasizing about how he would get rid of her for a long time. It was a very, we can say, innovative method that once they found the body was pretty easily traced back to him as the only person in the vicinity that had that kind of poison. So, yeah, probably pre-planned, but not well-planned, we can say.
Let's just talk about the method itself. BAM, it's a rare animal tranquilizer found in Suzanne's bones. So he used this sedative instead of brute force or, you know, a different type of weapon, a gun, you know, that would be messy if you're firing bullets off. He used, allegedly, a dart to tranquilize her to basically get her and take her down. No mess. Just a body that now has been poisoned and is likely going to die. What do you take? What's your take on that? Just the method itself, avoiding the mess, avoiding all of that, and avoiding having to exert the physical, you know, angst that a lot of abusers want to do on their subject. This was just a boom, she's down. There was no signs of struggle or broken bones or anything like that on her body when they found her.
Yeah, that speaks of pre-planning, right? And and what he thought he could control and get away with. And he was a hunter, and he took down animals with this substance all the time. So clearly this was something that was in his wheelhouse. He felt very confident and comfortable with it, and I guess was good at hitting moving targets at the same time. So it's, yeah, another weird thing that none of us would normally think about something like this, but for this guy, it makes sense.
It's like there was a moment of evil clarity of, well, if I do this, there won't be the big mess, but everything else didn't seem to be thought out too well. Let me ask you about this. I mean, this is going to be going towards, if this goes to trial, if the jury gets it, there's going to be argument about the BAM itself, because yes, Barry had past access to BAM from his deer farming days, and I say that loosely, in Indiana. He was the only private person in the region known to have it. Now, we don't know for sure, because they didn't find any on his person or in his home at the place where this murder did take place, and the purchase of the BAM would have actually been a couple years earlier, according to records. But, you know, he's an avid hunter. He's an avid guy that goes and rips antlers off of deer and leaves them to die, or lets them come back alive and rip them off again. He's a nice type of guy, you know? He's a lover, not a fighter. And he just that whole mindset of someone like that, having it at the time of the murder versus just ordering it far early on. The fact that we didn't have it in the residence here this time, but they found the dart cap or a dart cap. Is that going to leave some room for question of reasonable doubt if they didn't find the actual substance there? Again, not a crazy,
Yeah, I guess if I could put myself in the position of being his defense attorney, that would be the one big thing to go for, is that you just don't have proof. But who knows? I don't think they know what was in all those trash bags he was throwing away either, right? That would be lovely to have access to that.
Yeah.
What was he getting rid of?
Yeah, because that doesn't show anything weird when he's going to seven different trash dumpsters around the area, dumping something unique at each location. And his excuse is, I just like to do that because I don't like to pay the landfill fees. Seven dumpsters?
Really? Seven dumpsters.
Were they all full and you just had to put a little, you only fit a little bit in each one? You know, it's a little odd. It looks a little suspicious.
It's also, you know, if we could give all these murderers a tip, it's like, realize there are cameras everywhere now. It's like they don't seem to put that together. And how many of these things are, you know, the dots are connected because of film footage that we get. Yeah.
It makes you wonder. I mean, I don't know. Are people looking at the gas station cameras that are hanging outside some of these places and they look kind of, you know, dusty, a little cobwebby? Ah, that probably doesn't work. And going with that, I don't know. I mean, they got to be telling themselves something, or they're just that ignorant and they don't think that part through. I don't know why one wouldn't at this day and age, but
that would be a good question to ask them. Did you ever stop and ponder that you were being filmed when you did all this?
Yeah, it's a good question to ask someone like that. Mm-hmm. If I'm ever, and I don't think I have, but if I ever do interview someone, a criminal who has gotten or attempted to get away with something caught on camera, that's a very just basic, but an obvious one that I don't think they get asked very often.
No. If you watch BritBox, all the British detective shows. I like that channel. Mm-hmm. And they're all caught with CCTV footage. Yeah. I mean, you know, in England, they would never catch a criminal if they didn't have CCTV everywhere. Yeah. So maybe in England, they're more aware of it.
Yeah. Suzanne reportedly said she didn't feel safe being alone with Barry. That's a big thing. She's telling it to friends. She's telling it to people, but she did go back there to get her stuff. If someone is feeling that way in a relationship, but they still have all their stuff at the house, maybe don't go there alone. And I'm not trying to victim shame or anything here. I'm just trying to say people need to think a little bit more. This is kind of what I was at to earlier of, it can't happen to me. It can't.
Yeah.
Can't. Do people need to be more aware of how real these sort of things are and how common they actually do take place?
I think so. I think that's one of the focuses of my work is trying to raise awareness of you know, the potential for violent outcomes when women are trying to get out of relationships. And anybody who doesn't feel safe around their partner, particularly if there are ongoing marital problems or they're trying to leave the relationship, I would encourage them to contact a domestic violence hotline. There's a national, you know, if you just put in Google National Domestic Violence Hotline, you can text them. It's a 24/7 service. A lot of communities have local domestic violence counseling services just to have some support and get some tips on how to stay safe. That's one of the big things their counselors do.
And another interesting point of this whole case is that his daughters, who were close to both parents, it wasn't like the marriage obviously was strained, but the relationship from what we know, the daughters, you know, they love both their parents very much. They were close with both. And they still stood by dad after he was almost going to trial a couple of years ago. I don't think mentioned that portion of this. This is the second time charges have been brought against him. They were dropped earlier on. Because there was misconduct, they believe, on the part of the prosecution, getting late for deadlines. The prosecution, the actually original prosecutors, were disbarred. That's a big thing there. But they still stayed with dad, and that's the point. There had to have been red flags. There had to have been some sort of signs in that home of coercive control or something, you know, growing up, that maybe things weren't the greatest with mom and dad. What's your take on this, that they still stand by him? Was this everything maybe too normalized that they just couldn't conceive of this happening? Or did Barry and Suzanne really hide it that well from the kids that they really would think this is a complete impossibility?
They probably did hide it pretty effectively from the kids, but also kids that grow up in incredibly dysfunctional homes don't know that it's abnormal.
Yeah.
And they tend to not see things. And he may, in very many ways, have been an adequate father for them and have a bond with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of like restricted his more pathological controlling behavior to his wife. And we do know that she suspected him of having affairs. She was having an affair. But all of this was very secret. Mm-hmm. And so the kids are probably at that difficult phase that we often talk about of just not being able to see that their father could be a murderer. It's just not in their reality at this point. So that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I can understand that. Suzanne had a secret affair for almost 2 years from a trauma and self-worth perspective. Now, what drives someone to emotionally check out of their marriage before just physically leaving it. Like, why stay? And it's a million-dollar question to everybody who does this. It's why not just leave? Why, yeah. You know, why go down that road? What do you think might have been going on in Suzanne's mind that kept her married to him, but still trying to get that fulfillment elsewhere?
Mm-hmm. It's definitely best before you have the affair to just end the relationship and get out of it. I think that's a cleaner break, a better way to do it. But so many people don't do it that way. And they desperately are looking for solace. They're looking for comfort. They're looking for support. And they often have affairs. It's sort of like a transitional object for them. And my guess also is that she was frightened to leave him, mm-hmm. and may have had a lot of anxiety about making the final break. And sometimes people have a long phase of having to work up to doing it. Mm-hmm. And in her case, I'm sure she was a homemaker. She had concerns about how she was going to get through it financially. And sometimes people have to go through a planning phase for, okay, what am I going to do? What is it going to look like? Am I going to end up with this other man that I'm seeing? As I understand, he was married and had 5 or 6 kids himself, mm-hmm. although they were talking about being together. So it really is fairly common for people to exit marriages by having affairs and taking their time in doing it.
Barry allegedly presented their marriage as being very happy. Obviously, while Suzanne was documenting feelings of being controlled. How common is it for abusers to present that false public image and also to believe their false public image, to really mm-hmm. think things are hunky-dory here, mm-hmm. the way I'm doing things, and not having any clue that your partner is that level of unhappy?
100%. You nailed it. And these folks are, of course, if you're a murderer, you're going to be cluster B. So you've got the narcissism there, always wanting to give a good impression publicly. And that doesn't surprise me. And in his mind, he was a great guy. And if there was any unhappiness, loneliness, dissatisfaction on her part, it was not on his radar at all. And he really didn't care.
Yeah. And there were a lot of signs in here that I guess when normalized, one wouldn't see until sometimes mm-hmm. you're out of that bubble. And maybe you would have seen it earlier. Maybe you would have seen it 10 years earlier and gone, huh? But once you're so far deep in, you're not realizing it. Barry allegedly was checking her spending, questioning her constantly, and policing her communications as well. So a lot of lack of trust. Mm-hmm. Is it lack of trust or need for control when someone is doing something like that? Because even if the person's not going out of control with spending, they're not doing anything crazy, there's no reason you need to police their communications. Mm-hmm. And you should not be in a relationship with anybody that you have to be doing those sort of things with.
No.
But the fact that, you know, someone is doing that, what is that a control or is that a I don't trust you type thing, or maybe a little bit of both in their mind?
Probably both, yeah, because a person like this often has some paranoid tendencies. They can misperceive benign things as someone is up to something or doing something to them, and that's just sort of this subtle style of thinking that they have. But the need to control is overwhelming, and that can confuse women for a long time, that they don't, you know, when they're used to it, they don't see how bizarre it is.
I would say for both parties, honestly, not in this case, but for both men and women, because both sides can very much do that to one another. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times it starts with an argument of, well, it's because I care about you. Well, it's because I love you, because I just want to make sure you're okay, or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, someone mm-hmm. is throwing out there. And maybe it starts innocently. Maybe it starts out of insecurity and they just want to know whatever the hell they want to know. Mm-hmm. But then it seems like once you give an inch with someone like that and go, okay, well, you can, We'll do Life 360, or we'll do the phone monitoring, turn my location on, that so many people do today. And then it's, well, let's, I want to know this too. And I want to know that too. That can be very insidious. And a lot of people don't tend to see that until it is too late. Where is the line on that? Like, where is the line where this is healthy? We just care about each other. And we just, you know, want to know where each other is if we needed it, not like I'm sitting here, where are you at? That doesn't look like the grocery store, you know, why are you in a neighborhood or some BS like that versus a healthy way of keeping tabs on each other out of care and love versus, control and, fear.
That's a really good question and probably a bit different with every couple. The red flag that I always notice is the compulsive checking of the other person's phone for texts. And now sometimes that can make sense because they have radar and there are a lot of things that feel like there's some duplicity going on here. And so they do get paranoid, but it's kind of grounded in reality. So they start, you know, sneaking, looking at the phone. And very often they find things. But as I tell people, if you're in a relationship where you have to try, you know, going through each other's email, checking phones, what are the other ones that they do? Recording as what's going on
secret
pen recording. When you have to secretly record each other, this is, you know, get to a marriage therapist quick or determine, do I really need to be in a relationship where this kind of stuff is going on? Now, my husband tracks my phone when I'm out of the house because I get lost. And we do live in a big city where if you go into certain parts of town, there can be carjackings and crime, and he says it just. I know he's doing it. I support that.
Yeah.
The problem was the time I took an Uber to the far end of town, and I accidentally left my phone in the Uber.
Yeah.
And so Mike was seeing my phone track all over the city in this wild pattern, and he was certain I had been kidnapped.
Sure. And,
so eventually we work that out. But don't leave your phone in the Uber. But yeah, there are times when I think it makes perfect sense. But when it's coming from a place of pathological control, where people really don't trust each other, I mean, that's the foundation of a good marriage is trust. You know, you want this person to be your safe person, not the person you have to walk on eggshells with or worry about.
And I would say that power, if it's been normalized of like, okay, we're watching each other, can also be used as a negative against the people as well. Like if it's okay, we're doing this because I care. And you're like, okay, you know, whatever, you go along with it for a long time. And then they go out to go do something and then they just disappear off of it. Then you can't track them when they're going out, but they want to track you when you're going out.
Very much.
Or let's just say they get really angry and then decide to disappear in Las Vegas and turn their tracking off. I've had that happen before.
Wow.
And they ended up on the highway and in a psych ward. Suzanne's last known location was out there in the yard. The GPS on Barry's phone shows him all over the place. He says he was hunting chipmunks. In the backyard, because there's a big chipmunk problem out there, I guess, and not his wife. Is that kind of a desperate? Do you think that was a question that surprised Barry when it came up? Like, why does your GPS show like you're all over the place?
Oh, I think he was very surprised at that one, because that is the lamest story. Where are all the little chipmunk bodies, right? How many chipmunks did you take out? Were they in the trash bag that that was all these bodies of chipmunks that he was dumping at the Holiday Inn trash? I mean, you know, weird. Yeah, I think that was a pretty lame one, Barry.
Dumping chipmunk bodies at the Holiday Inn trash. That's like the weirdest sentence I've heard.
I can do weird.
I like that. Chipmunk bodies at the Holiday Inn trash. Wouldn't that be a weird
title,
one?
Title for a book.
It is. You're emptying out your cooler. Ah, this ham's gone bad. What's in it? Oh my God, it's a box of chipmunks. things. Like, what's going on here? Although in Salida, Colorado, anything is possible. It really, truly is. Anyway, I think that'll wrap that up for our discussion here of what the hell's going on in this case. There's a lot to come as the progression of this goes, hearings and such, all on the way to determine if Barry Morphy was going to be going to trial in the coming, I'm going to say years at this point. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist, author of Nightbird. Go check it out wherever you get books. We'll talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.